You haven't tasted the sweet, sweet rock?
Yes! Chris Chin, ladies and gentlemen.
I get this weird, I have these weird experiences of meeting real game designers, and you're like, holy shit, you know about my game? Like, of course I know about your game. Like,
well, you know, you may have to start admitting to yourself that you are a real game designer and embrace that. We're recording here, we're talking with Ben Lehman, designer of Polaris, which has just won the Annie for Best Indie Game.
Indie RPG Awards.
Oh, this was my problem. Okay, I confused the Annies with the Indie RPG Awards. I don't think the Annies even have an Indie RPG Award.
I did not enter the Indies because it was too expensive for me to submit the books.
Really?
Yep. You have to submit 6 copies, and I get my books printed in a little copy shop, and so they cost like $6.50 each.
Really?
And so it's like $50, and I'm like, you know what? I'd rather just sell those books.
Are you all right with that being on the record? That's.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
I'm publicly on the record on the Forge. I think it's great that the Ennies, by the way, I think the Ennies are great awards. I was just going to say, I think it's really good. The Ennies have done a lot of outreach to the Forge and to indie designers in general. I think it's really great. The fact that I can't afford to submit to them is, in fact, recorded in public. And, you know, I think it might, maybe it's a flaw in the system. I don't know. But I think the awards are really, really cool. And I wish that I had the spare copies to submit.
Okay, so I've resolved my confusion now, at least. I confused the Indie RPG Awards with the time for when the Ennies were going to be announced.
Yeah, it's...
But yeah.
So, anyway.
But you've won the Indie RPG Award for Best Indie RPG for 2005.
Yes, and I also won Best Most Innovative. It was kind of surprising that I won the Best RPG Award. I really thought it was going to go to the Mountain Witch.
Well, it was just a super competitive year.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, and next year is going to be even more super competitive.
Oh, Lord, yes.
At this point, I played like 4 or 5 demos of the new games that are at the booth, just because I try to play every new game every year at least for 10 minutes.
Oh, I don't know that you're going to be able to even do that next year.
And yeah, we've already got, like, I'm already looking at, like, basically everything I played has blown my mind, and is making me kind of feel ashamed. 1001 Nights by McGay Baker, in particular, and Heroes Banner by Tim Kopang, are just astounding games, and you'll be seeing lots and lots of people talking about them, and you'll be probably seeing at least one RPGNet flame war about whether or not 1001 Nights is actually an RPG, and... I think it's going to be. I think that they're fantastic.
Okay, let's see where you stand on this. I mean, how important do you think it is to claim the term role playing game? I mean, is it time to put a flag out somewhere else and say, you know?
I'm basically terminologically agnostic.
Water.
I call Polaris a role playing game because I wrote it for people who played role playing games, and I think people who play role playing games will find it fun. I honestly don't have any emotional attachment to whether my games are called role playing games or not.
Right.
But I write games that I think people who play role-playing games will enjoy. And so, you know, I feel relatively comfortable using the term, but if, you know, someone wants to come up to me and say, oh, Polaris isn't really a role-playing game because of X, Y, and Z, it's such a poorly defined term. Okay. You know, if you feel that way, I can totally see your viewpoint.
Yeah. So, well, I think the name is useful, again, for outreach.
Yeah, well, it depends on what you're trying to reach out to. You know, different things. But, you know, I think actually also that role-playing games associated, of course, with D&D in almost everyone's heads that are not gamers. And I actually think that's really useful in terms of reaching out to non-gamers. A lot of people are very ashamed about D&D, D&D is really lame or whatever, but the fact of the matter is a lot of people played D&D in high school and then stopped, and most of those people had enormously positive experiences with it. And when I can tell people that I design role-playing games and they go, oh, like D&D, if I don't flinch and go, no, it's an improvisational storytelling experience, and I just go, yeah, it's like D&D, but it's like different like this. They almost invariably will tell me a story about when they played D&D and how it was fun or how they thought it was really interesting even though it wasn't for them or whatever. Right. And so I really think, if you're talking about outreach, it's not just necessarily outreach to gamers, but I think even for other people that can be a draw. Where you sort of go, so this is a role playing game.
Ben's not crazy enough. You got to talk to like me or John about like the future of role playing.
But you know,
you have to state your name for the record now.
Sorry, this is
Thomas
totally
Robertson.
Interrupted you.
No, it's fine. We're taking.
Oh, yeah, Thomas Robertson.
And the Thomas Robinson just got finished. I'm working on a game called Drifter's Escape. Right. And now, then again, having just said all that, I don't think I'm going to end up calling the Drifter's Escape a role-playing game. Even though it is. Thomas, you just played it, right? Your character, your situation, you're controlling your character.
It's less traditional than Polaris.
Wow.
Really? I would say it's more so, but whatever. Because I, the Drifter's Escape is hopefully, knock on wood when it's all over, it's still in production and playtesting, but it's going to be sold. My brother writes short stories, and it's short. The game is basically inspired by a combination of his short stories and country music. And it's going to be, the game is sold in an anthology with his short stories. And we're hoping that we're going to sort of sell that to both people who like my games and people who like his writing. I kind of think that there's something for either group, you know, that I think that these stories, especially the way he writes stories, and I can't really express how it is, but there's some very useful things for role-playing gamers in those stories.
Right.
And there's, I think, also to the group of people he's selling to, sort of the zine crowd, the thing, especially in terms of the indie games and the Forge-inspired games, the places where role-playing games are moving to right now are something that's very useful to them. And because, you know, they're trying to sort of decentralize media, you know. Everyone can publish their own thing. It's very similar to what's going on in indie publishing and role-playing games, but everyone's going to publish their own thing and so on and so forth. But I think it's even more revolutionary to sit down with your friends and make your media right there.
Yeah.
Right? Because then you're not just upsetting the sort of corporate hierarchy or whatever. You're upsetting the very idea that one person is the artist and produces art media for the for the entertainment and consumption of other people, but rather, okay, here we all are, and I don't want to say we're all artists. Here we all are, and we're all doing this thing because it's meaningful to us.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's. I think there's. I'm hoping to get some crossover in that. So I'm worried that if it's a role-playing game, people are going to go on their old D&D experiences and be like, oh, we'll just play this like D&D. And I think that would probably cause Drifter's Escape to just sort of collapse. So I don't know, but we'll see. I haven't finished writing the my part of that book yet, so
okay.
We'll see what I end up calling
it. Yeah, I do remember the ad that you've had, I think, in Under the Bed, that actually just called it a fiction game. So
yes, it's fiction game. I really, really like the term live fiction, which is me. There's a couple of terms, story games, so on and so forth. Live fiction is one that's been going around in coinage a little bit. I'm hoping to promote that a little bit more because I think it's a very, very good description of exactly what it is we do.
That is
good. Whereas a role-playing game, I think these are role-playing games in the broadest sense, but it sounds more like a therapeutic exercise.
Yeah, it kind of does. one of my big hobby horses for this weekend is thinking about theater and thinking about how, you know, it's a great first step to take your production of media and your entertainment into your own hands, but to me it almost seems like an extravagant waste when some people are making games that would make phenomenal entertainment for others. And also, I'm just thinking about the limits of how big a community can get before some of that community is going to be an audience anyway.
Well,
so I really have my eye on games that could be played in front of an audience.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting idea, but there's definitely some concerns. I mean, first of all, there's already a producer audience thing going on in role-playing games right now, which is story hours or actual play reports or game chronicles or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
There are people who get, I mean, Judd Carlman, who's just published his first role-playing book, supplement for Sorcerer called Dictionary of Moo.
Right.
Which is physically gorgeous.
It's a nice book. Yeah.
And he is enormously famous. In a very small group of people, but for posting, just talking about the games he played. And
he
has an audience. You know, his threads have an audience. But getting on what you're actually talking about, I think when you have an audience, it changes. Because when you have performers in front of an audience, the performers are trying to please the audience. And when we're all here and we're all active in the creative act that's going on, we're not trying to please anyone else. We're not getting paid to please anyone else. There's no external reward except our own joy and the joy of those fellow creators. And you get a very interesting feedback there. And I'm not saying you couldn't design a game to be played in front of an audience, but you need to take that into account.
Well, see, I think once you start designing those games, you're going to start changing what theater is, and it might not 100% be about pleasing the audience anymore. I would also say that theater isn't necessarily about that now.
Well, but, yeah, of course, you could get into avant-garde theater and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But I guess for me, I also write fiction. And in terms of if I'm going to like create a media object to give to somebody, if I'm not writing that to make them happy, I'm not, there's no reason, that's just self-indulgence.
Yeah, sure,
I might as well be playing a role-playing game. Because then I can be as self-indulgent as I want to be, as long as I'm jamming together with the other people
I'm
operating with. The only people who it needs to be okay with. It doesn't need to be okay with critics, it can be hackneyed, it can steal from stuff, it can do whatever. It doesn't need to be any audience, it can be bizarrely unpopular, as long as we are all into it.
Right.
And that's really powerful. I think it's really interesting what you're talking about, but I'm almost like, now you've triggered my, but that's not a role-playing game button. I would suggest, Mike, you design it.
Sure, no, I'm still doing the thinking.
And prove me wrong.
Next year may be a little too early. But yeah, I mean, I have a response to that, but instead I want to ask you the question I've been asking everybody. And people are largely kind of turning down my implicit invitation to get really bombastic and ambitious. But the question I'm asking is, where do you want to see story games, for lack of a better term, in 5 or 10 years?
Where do I expect to see them, or where do I want to see them?
Where do you want to see them?
I'm going to say something which is going to make everyone write me off as a total hippie.
Do it. I've been trying to get someone to do this.
I think that basically starting with the inception of mass media printing, which is printing is the first mass media.
Yeah.
And it increasing dramatically in the last 50 years with the expansion of copyright and so on and so forth. The human relationship to media, to art. I say media because people react funny to the word art, but when I say art, I really just mean stuff we enjoy.
Right.
Has become fundamentally mentally ill. I love books. I want to get in the stare, but reading a book is weird, right? A person writing and reading a book is weird. You write a book, you're alone in a room telling a story to no one. And when you read a book, you're alone in a room having a story told to you by no one.
Inside your head.
Well, yeah,
it's telepathy.
We used to have a name for people who sat in a room and told stories to themselves. Crazy people. The arts, the media, whatever, music, stories, dance, theater, all used to be things that everyone got together and did. And they've become increasingly isolated and owned by individuals or corporations rather than community activities that build community. So you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah, yeah.
So 5 or 10 years, okay, maybe the next 50 years. I want role-playing or whatever we're going to call it, live fiction or whatever we're going to call it, I want it to change the world. I want to fundamentally redefine the way that we interact with the creation of art and media. And I think it has the potential to do it. I think it needs, something needs to happen, but I think people crave it. When I sit down, when I can really sit down and play with somebody, and it's a simple game and we're not running up against barriers, they light on fire. Anyone, a gamer, not a gamer, it doesn't matter. It's just the act of getting together in a group and telling stories is this fundamentally human thing that almost no one does anymore. And the fact that we're doing it is deeply revolutionary. And I want that to be, I don't want it to replace mass media, because I don't think it can. And
I don't think you can put that genie back in the bottle.
I like books. I'm a writer, too. I like reading books. I like the physical objects. I like movies, you know. I even like soulless Hollywood blockbuster movies. I want people to realize that not only is art a thing that any individual can do, it's not hoity-toity, it's not fancy, whatever. It's something that we can all do together, and it's this totally natural, instinctual thing. And very, very pleasurable. And I want everyone in the world to have access to that as a concept.
Right on.
And be able to sit down and do it. Yeah, okay, so that's a little...
All right,
that
is a little... I mean, I wonder if we're ever going to overcome some people's aversion to the idea of applying rules to telling stories. Like, that seems to me to be a weird thing to do.
But we always apply rules when we tell stories.
Well,
right?
Yeah, stories have a lot of implicit rules.
But they even have explicit rules, right? If we're sitting in a circle and you're a storyteller, depending on what culture we're in, the way that the rest of us are going to interact with you, and there will be interactions no matter what, is different. So, for instance, modern American monologues. Storyteller gets up in the front of the audience, there's a microphone, the storyteller talks. The only two things the audience are allowed to do are laugh and applaud. And those are rules. That's an incredibly restrictive rule set.
That's not an explicit rule, I would argue.
I would say it's an explicit rule because if you start doing other things, you're not monologuing anymore.
It's not a rule that they put in your program.
That is true.
Yeah.
But then again, maybe the form, we're dealing with a form that is in its infancy. Role-playing is 30 years old. And maybe the final form of role-playing is not going to have explicit rules. Maybe it will be all implicit rules. I personally like explicit rules. I think implicit rules do interesting things. But I'm a weirdo. And the answer is, we don't know. And I think that we as game designers, as people who are coming out of this gaming tradition, these game players and game designers, are not going to be able to design the game which everyone in the world will be able to conceptualize. Not even just like. I don't care if it's a fad or not, but conceptually grasp.
Yeah.
So the thing to do, and you know, Ron has stuff he's doing with this right now, which he has some very interesting projects.
Let's say Ron Edwards.
Ron Edwards, yeah. Sorry.
Probably most people who are this deep into the interview will know that, but.
And well, maybe it will be edited down, since we'll be at the beginning. He's doing some interesting things with that. I'm trying to do some stuff with the Drifter's Escape. My own thoughts on it are that what we need to do, I don't think we can provide that. And what we need to do is set these ideas out, and let go of them. Don't get involved in fuss. And since this is a technical term for Forge, drift. It means when you change the rules to make the game more like a game you want to play.
Yeah.
And let people who have their own needs drift these rules, do their own things, and spread their own rules. And I think that requires a fundamental change in the way that we present our games and the way that we look at our games, and I think that I have no clue what that change is going to be. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, but I think it's going to be, you know, I'm trying to try something out with the Drifter's Escape. I'll be trying out more things later on. Who knows? And I don't expect to succeed, but I'd love to.
Right on. All right, now, have you... Well, I'm not even going to preface it. You can just tell me if you haven't. But what is the coolest thing that you've seen at the show that isn't a role-playing game? And, like, isn't at the Forge booth, you know, just isn't...
It isn't a role-playing game.
That is somewhere out there.
I've been looking at a lot of role-playing games that are at the Forge booth, but I've only seen, like, three things that aren't role-playing games because I'm spending my entire time in the dealer's hall. I could totally do a cop-out and say about how great it is to see my old friends from home who I haven't seen in a year.
Yeah.
But, you know, that probably is a cop-out.
Yeah, well, I think that it does really transform a convention. I mean, last year at Gen Con, I knew one guy, the guy I was rooming with, and that made the con... I mean, he's a great guy. He wasn't the problem. The problem was that I didn't have a scene.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And so you're talking about, are you outside of your scene? And especially because I'm in jet lag, so I've been spending so much time to sleep. lying in bed staring at the wall in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
I haven't had a lot of time to go outside of that. So I'm going to cheat on your question. I'm going to talk about the coolest role-playing game that I've seen outside of the Forge booth, which is a game... Actually, the coolest thing about this is the company name. It's Oppressed Proletariat.
Yes, I went by those guys' booth.
They're awesome. They're these bizarre indie game designers from the middle of nowhere that I've never heard of. And they have this game called the Mr. Lincoln Experiment, which is this surreal, they call it a surreal post-apocalyptic satirical romp. And you have a stack of business cards, and you use the business cards to generate your character, the situation, all of the NPCs, including their attributes. I believe you use it for the magic system, although I didn't get to that in the demo. I played a demo of it. I played Abraham Lincoln, brought back from the dead as a brain-eating ghoul. I was saying the Gettysburg Address while I was eating out of this guy's skull. The other guy was playing this random brownie with a crossbow. We fought some construction workers. It blew my mind. It's one of these games that I'm going to buy, and I'm just going to pore over it and be like, okay, what can I steal from this?
And
like,
they had another game that was all about... It was the
Intergalactic Cooking Challenge.
That's the title. Okay, that's what I couldn't remember. It's an Iron Chef based game.
Essentially. Yes, basically the high premise of that game is that aliens come to Earth. These aliens, they basically travel around making contact, and Earth disgusts them. Everything about it is horrible. We're fighting each other, you know, everything, all our art and music, and they basically say to Earth, okay, bring us something that proves that you can live. And so the art, and they all the art and history, and like, yeah, whatever, it's amateurish, and all the music, and like, oh, it sounds awful, right, so on and so forth. Then the last day before it's going to be destroyed, this alien sees this guy eating a pickled pepper, and he thinks about, oh my god, think about the, you know, years of work in making that vinegar and the months that it sat in there. It's the cuisine of Earth. It's the only thing about Earth that, you know, matters. Really? And then so Earth has to prove, basically you have to go and cook for aliens to save mankind.
When I went by these guys' booth, I thought, oh my god, it's the Forge Heartbreakers. They're coming, this, and this is based on the term Fantasy Heartbreaker, which Ron Edwards came up with for kind of...
I'm supposed to be the jargony theorist.
Okay, you want to take a tack on this?
I was going to say, the Fantasy Heartbreaker is basically a game which is one conceptual step removed from AD&D. So, it's not necessarily bad games. There are some incredibly good Fantasy Heartbreakers. In fact, some of the very successful games, like the Fantasy Trip, which later became GURPS.
Right.
Or Fantasy Heartbreakers. It's the
or
reason
Rift.
Why they're right, or, yeah, Palladium is another one. The reason why they're Fantasy, why they're Heartbreakers is not necessarily because they're bad. Almost all of them have, as Ron said, everyone says in his essays, which you can read on The Forge,
yes.
Every single Fantasy Heartbreaker has one good idea in it, at least.
Yeah, but I mean, the word heartbreaker is in there for a reason.
The heartbreak...
A lot of these things broke the hearts of the people who created them.
Right, because the market can't accept D&D clones.
Yeah.
That said, the term has gotten co-opted and shuffled and used for all sorts of things at this point. And so basically, a lot of people lose a lot of money producing these games. They're often incredibly beautiful books.
Yeah.
It's just like no one wants to buy them, and so they end up getting pulped often. And but anyway, the Forge Heartbreaker term is basically turning that around and saying, okay, so people who have like read like a couple of Ron's essays in The Forge and maybe poked around, and they're like, I'm gonna design a game and it's gonna be resolved with toothpicks, and you're all gonna play artists from the 15th century in England, and it's all about your homosexual affairs.
That sounds awesome.
I'm not going to design that game, for the record.
But
do not quote me out of context.
Well, you know, there's two of us here. You know, I fucking designed a game about owlbears a couple weeks ago. Anything could happen, you know? But yeah, I mean, when I thought these guys are the Forge Heartbreakers, I was thinking, these guys might not get their hearts broken.
Right.
You know?
Well, and I really like their games, so I was trying to send people from the Forge booth over there. It's like, you have to see these guys' games. I mean, when game designers say that to each other, it sounds like it's a compliment, but it's actually just like, you must steal from these people. These people have steal-worthy stuff. But also, I tried to get them in touch with Brennan from IPR, Indie Press Revolution, which you've heard about a lot on this podcast.
Yes.
In fact, recently won an award.
Yes.
And I really hope that they do well, because I really want to see those games have more influence. I think that the Forge is really kind of getting stuck in some patterns. And so I'm really glad that we're also spawning these sort of outside, or that's really arrogant to take credit for it, that there are these outside indie groups also doing different crazy shit with their games. Because otherwise we're just going to become an intellectual cesspool, and every generation of games is just going to be another game where you set stakes and you roll the die and the winner gets narration, and then you have some relationship mechanics, and that's it. And I love a lot of those games. I mean, Primetime Adventures, which fits almost all of those, is my favorite game. But we need to be doing other things.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other things being done right now. 1001 Nights, which I mentioned, is brilliant. It has no resolution mechanic at all, but it works so well. But you know, I think that's a real worry, and so I'm really glad that it's been great to be at this Gen Con and see, coming from the Forge booth, yes, but also from tons of other trajectories, just really astonishing new game design ideas. Also, some really astonishing old game design ideas. I was talking with Chris Engel today, who makes Engel Matrix games,
right,
which continue to astonish 10 years later. So he talked me into buying one of his Sherlock Holmes sets. So I'm looking forward to that.
All right. Well, Ben Lehman, thank you for having entirely too much energy for this time of the night, and congratulations on your Indie RPG award. And
thanks for being
with us.
Thank you. Yeah, this is really good to talk to you. I listen to your podcast all the time. So.
Oh. Well,
I won't listen to this one because I hate hearing the sound of my own voice on tape.
Fair enough.